From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from Washington, D.C.
Today, here in Pennsylvania, you made your voices heard. And because of you, the tide is turning.
We can't afford to play the same Washington games with the same Washington players and expect a different result.
Hillary Clinton beats Barack Obama by 10 points in Pennsylvania. We'll get analysis of last night's results and host a roundtable with Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women. She's endorsed Clinton. Bill Fletcher, the executive editor of the Black Commentator. He supports Obama. And Green Party activist Ted Glick. He's endorsed Cynthia McKinney. Then federally funded scientists spread fertilizer made from human and industrial waste on yards in poor black neighborhoods to test whether it might protect children from lead poisoning in the soil. We'll speak with the AP reporter who broke the story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Senator Hillary Clinton has won the Pennsylvania primary, beating Senator Barack Obama by 10 percentage points. Clinton received 55% of the vote, Obama 45. Pennsylvania was seen as a must-win state for Clinton.
Today, here in Pennsylvania, you made your voices heard. And because of you, the tide is turning. We were up against a formidable opponent who outspent us 3-1. He broke every spending record in this state, trying to knock us out of the race. Well, the people of Pennsylvania had other ideas today.
The race now heads to Indiana and North Carolina, which both hold primaries May 6. Senator Barack Obama spent Tuesday night in Evansville, Indiana, where he addressed supporters in a speech largely focused on the presumptive Republican nominee, John McCain.
We can't afford to play the same Washington games with the same Washington players and expect a different result. Not this time. Not now. We already know what we're getting out of the other party's nominee. John McCain has offered this country a lifetime of service, and we respect that. But what he's not offering is any meaningful change from the policies of George W. Bush.
Although Clinton won by 10 percentage points in Pennsylvania, she only gained about 9 pledged delegates. According to NBC political analyst Chuck Todd, it now appears impossible for Obama to lose his lead in pledged delegates. Meanwhile, the editorial page of the New York Times has blasted Clinton for her campaign tactics. In an editorial entitled The Low Road to Victory, the editors write, quote, "It's past time for Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton to acknowledge that the negativity for which she is mostly responsible does nothing but harm to her, her opponent, her party, and the 2008 election." We'll have more on the race after headlines. In other news, the World Food Program has begun describing the global food crisis as a silent tsunami that threatens to plunge more than 100 million people on every continent into hunger and poverty. World Food Program Executive Director Josette Sheehan said a large-scale global response is needed to combat what she described as the biggest challenge ever faced by the World Food Program.
Well, we're seeing the rising food prices affect virtually every market in the world. The difference is, for the richer countries, there's more resiliency. We can give up desserts. We can give up meat once or twice a week. For people making less than a dollar a day, there's nowhere to retreat. And so what we are seeing is, in places where people were not desperate before, more people hungry, more people cutting out vital parts of their diet, including some going to one meal a day. And so in those cases, we really feel we need a strategy to work with those governments and communities to help people meet this increased need.
That's World Food Program Executive Director Josette Sheehan. Meanwhile, World Vision, one of the world's largest humanitarian organizations, has announced it cannot feed 1.5 million people that it fed last year because of the rising cost of food and the increased need. World Vision said the cutback could affect donations to 35 of the 100 countries in which the agency works. World Vision has already been forced to eliminate its food aid programs in East Timor and Sri Lanka, and reductions have been made in aid sent to Burundi, Niger, Cambodia, and Sudan. In news from Latin America, Colombian authorities have ordered the arrest of President Álvaro Uribe's cousin for suspected ties to paramilitary death squads. Mario Uribe is a former senator who's been one of Álvaro Uribe's closest allies for years. Uribe's arrest could hurt Colombia's bid to secure a free trade deal with Washington. Last night, Mario Uribe attempted to avoid arrest by seeking asylum in the Costa Rican embassy in Bogota. But the Costa Rica denied the request. Colombian human rights activist Ivan Cepeda criticized Uribe for trying to avoid being arrested.
It's an unprecedented occurrence that a senator of the Republic, who has been required by authorities, is fleeing justice and appeals for political asylum so that his crimes and acts remains unpunished in Colombia.
Meanwhile, at the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America Summit in New Orleans, President Bush urged Congress to pass the Colombian free trade deal.
An agreement with Colombia would level the playing field. And a failure to pass an agreement would send a terrible signal to our neighborhood. The Speaker of the United States Congress has killed this bill unless she gives us a date certain for a vote. And it's a bad decision on her part. And it's bad for our hemisphere to have the United States of America turn its back on a mutual friend like Colombia.
The Washington Post reports at least two dozen former and current prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere say they've been given drugs against their will or witness other inmates being drugged. The allegations have resurfaced after the release this month of a 2003 Justice Department memo that explicitly condoned the use of drugs on prisoners. In the memo, former Justice Department lawyer John Yoo rejects a decades-old U.S. ban on the use of mind-altering substances on prisoners. Instead, he argued that drugs could be used as long as they did not inflict permanent or profound psychological damage. Legal experts and human rights groups say that forced drugging of prisoners for any non-therapeutic reasons would be a particularly grave breach of international treaties banning torture. In news from Africa, a top UN official said the death toll in Sudan over the past 5 years may now be as high as 300,000. John Holmes, UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, mentioned the new estimate in a speech at a UN Security Council meeting on the conflict in the Western Sudanese region.
A study in 2006 suggested that 200,000 had lost their lives from the combined effects of the conflict. That figure must be much higher now, perhaps half as much again. Yet we continue to see the goalposts receding to the point where peace in Darfur seems further away today than ever.
Sudan's UN ambassador, Abdul Mahmoud Abdul Alim, said the figure was grossly exaggerated.
The death of even a single Sudanese is something very regrettable and tragic. But in our own calculations, the total number does not exceed 10,000.
A federal appeals court ruled Tuesday that former EPA chief Christine Todd Whitman cannot be held liable for telling residents near the World Trade Center that the air was safe to breathe after the September 11th attacks. The ruling came in response to a lawsuit by residents, students and workers in Lower Manhattan and Brooklyn who said they were exposed to hazardous dust and debris from the fallen Twin Towers after September 11th. In media news, Rupert Murdoch has put forward a $580 million bid to buy the New York-based newspaper Newsday. If the deal is approved, this would give Murdoch control of three of the nation's 10 largest circulation papers, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Post, and Newsday. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, The Wall Street Journal's top editor, Marcus Brauchy, resigned in a move that will give Murdoch more power to remake the paper, which he bought in December. A New Jersey man has been arrested on four counts of conspiracy and espionage for allegedly providing Israel with U.S. military secrets on nuclear weapons, fighter jets, and missiles in the 1980s. Banami Karish is a former U.S. Army engineer who worked at the Army's Picatinny Arsenal in Dover, New Jersey. He's reportedly acknowledged to the FBI he acted to help Israel. Karish is accused of reporting to the same Israeli government handler who is the main contact for Jonathan Pollard, an American citizen serving a life term for spying for Israel. Haaretz reporter Yossi Melman said the arrest will stain Israel's reputation.
The significance of this affair is that it is clear now that Pollard was not the only spy Israel operated in the United States on American soil, as Israel had claimed at the time. In terms of the quantity and quality of this espionage affair, I would say it doesn't match the magnitude of Pollard.
In Pennsylvania, three female members of the group MOVE have been denied parole. They've been held since 1978, following a police raid on their Philadelphia headquarters. During the raid, a police officer was shot dead. Nine members of the group were convicted of third-degree murder. 7 years after the 1978 raid, Philadelphia police bombed the MOVE headquarters, killing 11 members of the group, including five children. And a federal judge has dismissed charges against a University of Buffalo art professor who was charged with mail and wire fraud after the FBI found harmless bacteria used in art displays in his apartment. The judge said the charges against Steve Kurtz were, quote, insufficient on its face. Kurtz was originally investigated for bioterrorism. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're on the road in Washington, D.C. I'm Amy Goodman. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton has kept her presidential campaign alive with a 10-point victory over Senator Barack Obama in Pennsylvania's Democratic primary. She won with 55% of the vote to Obama's 45%. Turnout was heavy at many polling places, with an estimated 2 million Democrats voting. That's nearly triple the number who turned out in the past two presidential primaries in Pennsylvania. A partial delegate count from last night's primary gives Clinton a net gain of 10 delegates. Overall, Clinton still trails Obama in both the pledged delegate count and the overall popular vote. But the win gives her added leverage to stay in the race for the nine remaining contests beginning in Indiana and North Carolina next month. After her victory was announced, Clinton addressed supporters at a rally in Philadelphia.
Here in Pennsylvania, you made your voices heard. And because of you, the tide is turning. We were up against a formidable opponent who outspent us 3-1. He broke every spending record in this state, trying to knock us out of the race. Well, the people of Pennsylvania had other ideas today. You know, the presidency is the toughest job in the world, but the pressures of a campaign are nothing compared to the pressures of the White House. And today, Pennsylvanians looked through all the heat and saw the light of a brighter tomorrow, a tomorrow of shared prosperity and restored world leadership for peace, security, and cooperation. After 7 long years of President Bush, we've got our work cut out for us, and we don't have a minute to waste. So it's high time we stop talking about our problems and start solving them. And that is what my campaign is all about.
On top of her delegate and popular vote deficit, Clinton is far behind Obama in fundraising. Obama raised $42 million last month, doubling Clinton's $21 million. The Clinton campaign says it ended March in debt and is urging supporters to donate. Senator Barack Obama, meanwhile, was already campaigning in Indiana, where he addressed supporters in Evansville.
We have a choice in this election.
We can be a party that says there's no problem with taking money from Washington lobbyists, from oil lobbyists and drug lobbyists and insurance lobbyists. We can pretend that they represent real Americans and look the other way when they use their money and influence to stop us from reforming health care or investing in renewable energy for yet another 4 years. Or this time, we can recognize that you can't be the champion of working Americans if you're funded by lobbyists who drown out their voices. We can do what we've done in this campaign and say we won't take a dime of their money. We can do what I did in Illinois and in Washington and bring both parties together to rein in their power so we can take our government back. That's the choice we have in this election. We can be a party that thinks the only way to look tough on national security is to talk and act and vote like George Bush and John McCain. We can use fear as a tactic, the threat of terrorism to scare up votes, or we can decide that real strength is asking the tough questions before we send our troops in to fight.
For more on Tuesday's vote in Pennsylvania, Will Bunch joins me on the phone from Philadelphia, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News and author of the blog Attitude.com. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Will Bunch.
Yeah, hi, Amy. Thanks for having me back on the show.
It's good to have you with us. Why don't you start off by just laying out the results, how it broke down, the win of Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania?
Well, I mean, it's amazing, or maybe it's not so amazing, but it really broke out exactly the way people predicted it was going to break out, the way this whole thing started, which is that geographically, I mean, Hillary Clinton's strongest spots were Western Pennsylvania, the Pittsburgh area. She won overwhelmingly, and also the area around Pittsburgh that people tend to call a deer hunter country. And she did very well in the central part of the state, which is tends to be more rural. And Barack Obama, won Philadelphia, which everybody expected. He won about 90% of the African American vote, and that's a big portion of the Democratic vote here in Philadelphia. He did well in the Philadelphia suburbs, although, and I want to sit down this morning and look at the numbers again. It was a little bit surprising in that some early like exit polling suggested he was going to do better in the Philadelphia suburbs than he may have actually done. It looks like at the end of the night that it was actually kind of a split, that they split the Philadelphia suburbs 50-50, and that may explain why Hillary Clinton's final margin was 10%, 55-45, whereas, some final polls showed it might be like a 5 or 6% race. And I think the ground that she made up in the Philadelphia suburbs may have had something to do with that. She overwhelmingly won Bucks County, which is an important suburb that's just north of Philadelphia that is kind of mixed. The lower part of Bucks County is kind of a blue-collar, almost urban demographic. So which is a strong area for her. Just by demographics, they each played to their strengths. Obama, overwhelmingly won African Americans, and he also did well in areas that have high college graduate populations. Chester County, which is kind of a high-tech, upscale area west of Philadelphia, he won. And Hillary Clinton won the areas that were more unionized and more blue-collar. And you can't also underestimate senior citizens because Pennsylvania, as you may know, is the third oldest state in the country after Florida and West Virginia. We have a huge senior citizen population here, and Hillary Clinton won that overwhelmingly. So, given the demographics here, it's she was expected to win, and she won.
The African American population?
I'm sorry, Amy. What did you say about the African American?
The African American population breakdown.
The African American population in Pennsylvania is about average, or maybe slightly more than average compared to other states. I think it's about in the same 12-13% range you find nationally. So, and it's heavily concentrated in Philadelphia, which is why you see big numbers for Obama coming out of the city. Although again, he actually underperformed what some pundits thought he was going to do in Philadelphia. Some people thought he'd get 70% of the vote here in Philadelphia. Actually, it looks like he got more like 65%.
And how does Pennsylvania compare to Ohio, another win for Hillary Clinton?
Well, that's a good question, and actually I got into that a little bit on my blog this morning because a couple things. I mean, there's some differences. I mean, Pennsylvania is actually, you know, older than Ohio, and perhaps at least in parts of the state more industrialized than Ohio is, if that's possible. But one thing that the Obama people are saying, and I forget what the final numbers were in Ohio, but I know that it was more than a double-digit loss for Obama. I think it was like 14 or 16 points that he lost Ohio by, and he did better than that in Pennsylvania. And the Obama people put out a memo last night, and obviously some of it was spin, but I think some of it was worth thinking about in the sense that Obama did much better among older voters, and he did much better among white males in Pennsylvania than he did in Ohio. Some of the spin is that his campaign is faltering or falling apart. But when you look at the big picture, these are votes that he started out not doing well in, and you can argue he's actually doing slightly better among some of these voting groups. So, so much of this just gets into expectations and momentum rather than stepping back and looking at the big picture sometimes.
Clinton's main argument is that Pennsylvania will be a key battleground state in November, and she's won it, and Obama couldn't beat McCain there. Your response, Will Bunch?
I just don't see that. I mean, I think, I think the closer we get to November, I think, Democrats are Democrats. I mean, they're never going to fully unify, but I think they will get fairly unified in Pennsylvania. I mean, they each, I think, bring something and lose something in running against McCain in the fall. I mean, I think what Obama wins is he does have that appeal to some of these affluent suburban voters outside of Philadelphia. And remember, historically those voters were Republicans. I mean, these counties, this ring of four counties that surrounds Philadelphia, historically has always been a Republican area, and it's always been particularly fond of people who were at least perceived, anyway, as moderate Republicans, like the way that some people still perceive John McCain. John McCain is supported by a popular former Republican governor of Pennsylvania, Tom Ridge, which might help him some in the state. So the fact that Obama has pretty strong appeal in some of these more affluent suburbs, I think, is a good thing for the Democrats. On the other hand, I think the argument that Clinton can make in her favor about November in Pennsylvania is her strength in western Pennsylvania, and particularly among a group that your listeners may have heard of called the Reagan Democrats. The Pittsburgh area is kind of the Reagan Democrat capital of the country. I mean, you had this demographic of steel workers and factory workers and coal miners who, had been Democratic voters during the New Deal, and during the 80s, social issues caused them to flip and vote Republican in presidential elections. Hillary Clinton, I think, definitely holds on to those voters, whereas with Obama, I think it would be fairly competitive for those voters against McCain. So I think that's her argument. The big picture, again, I think Pennsylvania has been trending towards being a blue state for the last two decades. I mean, the last Republican presidential candidate who won here was George H.W. Bush in 1988. John Kerry won here. Al Gore won here. No matter what McCain has going for him, I think it's going to be very hard for a Republican to win this state, given the economy, given the war situation.
Will Bunch, both candidates, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, came before your newspaper, Philadelphia Daily News editorial board, looking for their endorsement. Can you talk about the questions you all ask them?
I think when you take a step back, I think we liked both the candidates. Our editorial board ended up endorsing Obama, but we, thought they both put on pretty strong performances. Some of it had to do with what you might call the day-to-dayness of the campaign, in the sense that the day that Hillary Clinton came to the editorial board was the day that the whole Bosnia sniper fire story was breaking, and in fact, we made some news because we were the first ones to really ask her about it in person and got her to, concede that she had made a misstatement or that she had misspoke on that. And, that kind of overshadowed maybe some of her other you know, policy discussions, which were, you know, which were good. You know, obviously, we've seen her in the debate, and she's very good in handling policy questions. You know, and so was Barack Obama. I mean, he tended to, again, if you've seen the debates, he tended to give kind of longer, kind of more cerebral, if that's the right word, answers. But he still impressed people. I mean, for me, the one thing that stood out about Obama coming to the newspaper was I had a chance to ask him about what he might do as president in dealing with some of these news stories that came out this month about, you know, the torture policies and torture meetings in the Bush White House, and whether he would ask his attorney general to look into these. And you know, he gave a good answer. I mean, he's obviously thought about it, and he said he wants his Justice Department, if he's elected, to review these things. You know, he also is big on reconciliation. So his answer, you know, was a little bit noncommittal, but at least I was glad to be able to have a chance to get him on the record. I mean, one of the things we really liked here in Pennsylvania about having this six-week primary is it was a chance for a lot of us to meet both the candidates and ask them questions, not just newspaper people, but average citizens, you know, had more of a chance to get a measure of these candidates. And, so in the end, in terms of the democracy, which of course is the theme of the show, I mean, it was a good thing for democracy.
Will Bunch, I want to thank you for being with us, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, author of the blog Attitude.com. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, a roundtable discussion about the 2008 race. Stay with us. Clock by Simeon Mobile Disco here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're in Washington, D.C. on the road. Tonight we'll be in New York at the Community Church at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting from New York as well, and then we move on to Los Angeles, Fresno, Minneapolis, and Columbia and St. Louis, Missouri over the next few days. We continue now our election coverage by turning to three guests. Here in Washington, D.C., Kim Gandy, President, National Organization for Women. She's endorsed Hillary Clinton. We're also joined by Bill Fletcher, executive editor of the Black Commentator, former president of the Trans-Africa Forum. His forthcoming book is called Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. Bill Fletcher is endorsing Barack Obama. And we're also joined by Ted Glick. Ted Glick is a Green Party member who has endorsed Cynthia McKinney. We welcome you all to Democracy Now!, but we're going to begin with Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women. She's been traveling the country, stumping for Hillary Clinton. Kim Gandy, you were in Pennsylvania. First, your response to the primary yesterday there.
Well, obviously, all of Hillary Clinton's supporters were delighted by the outcome of the primary. A double-digit lead was what we had all hoped for. We traveled all over the state talking to people from one end to the other and got a very, very strong response, especially people who made their decision in the last few days 1 to 3 days went nearly 20 points for Hillary Clinton.
And what was your observations as you stumped through Pennsylvania? Where did you go? What are the issues that you're focusing on?
My focus was on behalf of the National Organization for Women, PAC. I was talking about women's issues and things that affect women and families, and what Hillary Clinton has done and how she's worked with us and worked on these issues all the way back to the Equal Rights Amendment campaign in the 70s and early 80s, right up to working for equal pay and the Fair Pay Act, which, by the way, is coming to the floor tonight. Senator Clinton will be flying back to vote on that and to speak on the floor. And so I went from, let's see, from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh to Lancaster, Elizabethtown, Kutztown, Allentown, really made the rounds of the state, talking mostly to women about why Hillary Clinton is the candidate who will best support women's rights and family issues.
Bill Fletcher, you have endorsed Barack Obama. You're executive editor of The Black Commentator. Why? And your response to his defeat yesterday in Pennsylvania.
I think, Amy, that that he actually did very well yesterday, that he we have to keep in mind the context. He was expected to lose Pennsylvania. He was expected by many people to lose substantially in Pennsylvania. He closed the gap. I think that he, all things considered, did quite well, and the campaign has simply not lost momentum. The my reasons for backing Obama is that I think that on the issues that he is better positioned and that he offers an opportunity, beginning with his inauguration in 2009, to change the direction of the country and particularly to change the relationship between the United States and the rest of the planet. So I'm excited about the possibilities, and I'm not despairing. I mean, let's keep the context in mind. I think he did quite well.
You didn't always come out with an endorsement. Can you talk about what made you endorse Barack Obama?
No, that's quite correct. I've had differences, and I still have differences with the senator. And I think that he needs to be stronger in certain issues, particularly in foreign policy and health care. But I think that we're now in a very different position than we were several months ago. We have these two candidates, and we have one candidate who has touched a nerve within the United States and has mobilized this very fascinating constituency of younger voters, of voters that have been alienated in the past, who are looking for change. And I think what we're seeing is actually a rebellion in the ranks against the years of the Bush administration, but actually as well against the politics that was played out during the Clinton era. That's what I think progressives need to capitalize on. That's why I think it's so important for us to get involved in the campaign now and make a difference.
Ted Glick, you're a Green Party activist. You're supporting Cynthia McKinney. What is your assessment of what happened in Pennsylvania?
The problem with what happened in Pennsylvania, as happened in all of the other states where there have been elections, Democratic primary elections, particularly since it's been Obama and Clinton, is that major issues are just not being addressed. We have no candidate, no horse in the race, who is calling for single-payer universal health care, for example. We have no candidate who is saying that we need to get out of Iraq and we need to renounce our demand, our desire for Iraq's oil. No candidate has said that we should not be about privatizing Iraq's oil. It's their oil for them to use as they see fit. We have no candidate who is against the building of more coal plants. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama support so-called clean coal, which is an oxymoron. There is no such thing. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama support nuclear power, which is not a solution to the climate crisis. So the problem that we have is that until the media begins to cover other candidacies that are out there, Cynthia McKinney is the likely candidate of the Green Party when it holds its convention in July. We need options. We need alternatives. We need consistent progressives out there. That's what Cynthia McKinney offers. That's why I support her.
I wanted to go back to Kim Gandy and ask you about the whole issue of the Democratic Party being divided right up until the convention, that this is a key moment for Democrats, unless they destroy each other before the election. Your response, Kim Gandy.
Well, if you look back at Bill Clinton, he didn't get the nomination, and he didn't clinch the nomination, at least until June. So I don't think there's any real problem with the race carrying on until June. And in fact, it seems to be inspiring people. We get more and more new Democratic registrations every day. The Democratic voters, the Democratic electorate is turning out in record numbers for primaries across the country. Clearly, the Democrats are electrified by the choices that they have. And so I think that this is good for the party. And frankly, it keeps John McCain completely out of the news.
The quote of the New York Times, the editorial that they just did called The Low Road to Victory, saying, it's past time for Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton to acknowledge that the negativity for which she's mostly responsible does nothing but harm to her, her opponent, her party, and the 2008 election.
Well, I really disagree with that. My experience with this campaign has been that certainly the negativity that I've seen has been coming from Senator Obama. He went sharply, sharply on the attack the last few days. And that really shows up in the fact that the people who decided in the last few days went for Senator Clinton. I think that's because of the very, very sharply critical attacks that he's made. But you know what? He hasn't had to do much challenging of Senator Clinton because the mainstream media has done that for him. She has focused on her experience. He's the one who's been making character attacks and questioning whether she's trustworthy.
Why do you think that Hillary Rodham Clinton hasn't endorsed single-payer Kim Gandy?
You know, she has had a commitment to health care for as long as I've known her, and has taken she started off trying to do it big and got hit with Harry and Louise. And in fact, Senator Obama's ads really echoed Harry and Louise. They looked just like the picture of Harry and Louise, even a husband and wife sitting around the dinner table with the bills in their hands, criticizing her in the same way that her original plan was criticized. But I think what she learned from that experience is that we can go only so far, one step at a time. But she's taken the biggest bite. Her plan would cover every single American, would not leave anyone out. We, as at the National Organization for Women, certainly support single-payer universal coverage. That would be our first choice. I wish our candidate were endorsing that. But her plan, nonetheless, is the best one out there and covers everyone.
Bill Fletcher, let me ask you the question of single-payer as well. Why Barack Obama, you think, has not endorsed a single-payer health care system, which takes out the insurance industry and their profits from the health care equation?
Well, Amy, I can give this answer very bluntly, in part because I'm not speaking for the campaign. I actually think he's been playing it too safe. I think that, and in that sense, I agree very much with what my friend Ted Glick was saying. I think that, you know, that there needs to be much more of a push on the issues. And I think that, unfortunately, Senator Obama has thought that this might hurt his coalition. So I do think he needs to be pushed. But I want to say one other thing, Amy. I'm trying to figure out whether we're in the same country when I hear these comments about Senator Obama's alleged negativity. I mean, let's be clear about who it was that kept the issue of Reverend Wright alive. Who it was that implied that there was a problem with the relationship between Senator Obama and Bill Ayers in Chicago. I mean, there has been this undercurrent that comes very close to red baiting that has been coming out of the campaign, which I think does a disservice to the Clinton campaign. So I think that there really is a time where people need to pull up and be a little bit more humble in their approach.
Well, Kim Gandy, let me put that issue back to you, the issue of Hillary Clinton on negativity around Reverend Wright on raising other issues that aren't to do with basic issues in the campaign around health care, around war.
Well, certainly my experience with the campaign was that they stayed away from the Reverend Wright issue. The first I recall Hillary Clinton saying anything about it was when she was asked what would she have done if this had been her pastor, if her pastor had said such things. And she said that she wouldn't have continued going to that church. I don't consider that a negative attack. On the other hand, Senator Obama ran ads saying that Hillary Clinton had advocated for NAFTA, which was, according to the including her detractors who were around at the time, even they say that she not only didn't advocate for it, but actually argued against it inside the White House and urged that NAFTA not be undertaken. She said, if we do this, we'll never get health care.
Bill Fletcher.
Senator Clinton can't have it both ways, Amy. She goes after Senator Obama about his associations with Reverend Wright and with Bill Ayers, yet wants people to see her as distinct from the Clinton White House, yet claiming that she's ready to assume the presidency precisely because of her years in the Clinton White House. You simply cannot have it both ways. See, what this really speaks to, Amy, is, bottom line, Senator Clinton cannot significantly distinguish herself on the issues from Senator Obama. And in that situation, unfortunately, what happens is that many people turn to issues that are a bit inflammatory, that are provocative, rather than getting to the issues. Again, I want to go back to what Ted was raising. This campaign should be focusing on the issues. The media should be focusing on the issues, and they should be pushing the candidates, including the candidate I support, Senator Obama, on them, and push them so that they're specific about each of these questions.
Let me play a clip of Cynthia McKinney. I interviewed her earlier this year about her decision to leave the Democratic Party. You know, she's a longtime Democratic congressmember, and seek the Green Party nomination. This is some of what she had to say.
We have a whole huge swath of the potential electorate who don't even vote at all. And starting in 1968, many of them have said that the treatment of the Democratic Party, of people, their children, basically, who were outside of the Democratic National Convention and who wanted only to express their opposition to the Vietnam War, that was a tipping point for them. Others have said that 911 truth is a tipping point for them. The failure of the Democratic Party to support impeachment, which is really the ultimate form of accountability in our system, is a tipping point for them. And then, of course, we have this huge population of the African American community that has decided to withdraw itself completely from the electoral process. And Hurricane Katrina was like the last straw. And so what we now want to do is to bring those people back in and to demonstrate to them that it is possible for us once again to have this community of conscience of people who are willing to participate in the process and to make that participation based on shared values. And our values are first and foremost peace. The values that we have to express are ending the disparities, the glaring disparities based on race and class that exist in our country.
That is Cynthia McKinney, former Democratic congressmember from Georgia, now seeking the Green Party nomination for the presidency for 2008. Bill Fletcher, let me put this question to you. Are you saying, given your stand on issues and Cynthia McKinney's or Ralph Nader's, that you actually support Obama over their positions?
I support the candidacy of Senator Obama. I believe that both Ralph Nader and Cynthia McKinney are outstanding advocates for social justice. I don't think that you build political movements largely through national presidential elections. I think that if they really want to build a challenge, A, they could have run and should have run within a Democratic primary, but also that it's a longer-term process of building a movement. And so these once every 4 years, let's appear and say the right issues and expect that people will rally, I don't think it makes any sense. And there's no historical basis looking at the United States on the right or the left to see such a phenomenon working. So on the given what we have, given the kind of change that I think we can make in this country, I'm with Senator Obama.
And let me put that same question to you, Kim Gandy, on the issues, what McKinney represents, what Nader represents, why you stand for Hillary Clinton.
Well, Ralph Nader and I split on the issue of the Supreme Court several years ago when he said it didn't make any difference who the Republicans and the Democrats appointed to the Supreme Court, that they wouldn't mess with Roe v. Wade. And they've already done that. I love Cynthia McKinney. My organization worked for her actively and sent staff down to work for her in both of her elections. But in this case, Senator Clinton is the one that we have the longest and strongest relationship with, going all the way back to the years that she was in Arkansas working for the Equal Rights Amendment, supporting children's rights through her work at the Children's Defense Fund, legal aid, access to justice, all of the issues that we champion as an organization. Hillary Clinton has been there for us. She's not just talked about these issues. She's worked for them. She's committed her life to them. And we know that she's not going to stop. She's going to hang in there until she gets it done.
And Kim Gandy on the issue of war?
We are certainly a peace-oriented organization. We oppose the move to the Iraq war. But frankly, most of the senators at that time voted the same way that Senator Clinton did. And considering that Colin Powell was the one making the case to give George Bush that authorization, and that Colin Powell was at least an informal advisor to Senator Obama's campaign, I think that if Senator Obama had been in the U.S. Senate at that time, which he was not, I doubt that he would have left Colin Powell's arguments unheeded.
Ted Glick, finally, what strategy does Cynthia McKinney actually have to win?
Well, Cynthia McKinney has defined victory as getting 5% of the vote. She understands she is not going to be walking into the White House on January 20th, 2009. But a third-party candidacy, a national presidential candidacy that gets 5% of the vote, then gets resources from the federal government for party building. That's one thing, in terms of what Bill said, that I wanted to underline. It's not Cynthia McKinney, the individual, just all of a sudden running out there. She's running for the nomination of the Green Party that has been around for years, that is organized in almost every single state in the country, that is something like 250 people elected to office, local offices around the country right now. It has a track record. It's uneven in terms of its strength. But we need alternatives within a political system that is dominated by big money, by corporate power. It's a winner-take-all system where it's very difficult for third parties to exist, much less win elections. That needs to change. We are not going to change this country if all we have is the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. We need a consistently progressive third-party alternative. The Green Party and Cynthia McKinney's candidacy in particular has the potential to keep that dream alive and to build upon it this year.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Ted Glick, Green Party activist, supporter of Cynthia McKinney. I also want to thank Bill Fletcher, who was executive editor of the Black Commentator. And I want to thank Kim Gandy, head of National Organization for Women, for this roundtable discussion. We'll be back in a minute.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on the point from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit.
The revolution will not be televised by Gil Scott Heron. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. Lawmakers and the NAACP are calling for an investigation into reports that federally funded scientific experiments in 2000 spread sewage sludge on the yards in poor black neighborhoods to test if it could fight lead poisoning in children. The Associated Press reported on Sunday that researchers spread a mix of human and industrial waste from sewage treatment plants on the lawns of 9 low-income families in Baltimore and a vacant lot next to an elementary school in East St. Louis. The families were told the sludge was safe and not informed about the toxic ingredients the sludge could contain. The report implicated researchers and funders from Johns Hopkins University, the Kennedy Krieger Institute, and the Environmental Protection Agency, the Housing and Urban Development Administration, and the Agriculture Department. The researchers say the experiment successfully reduced the amount of lead in the soil, but some scientists question the findings, as well as the choice of neighborhood and lack of transparency with the residents. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee will convene a hearing on the subject next month. I'm joined right now in Washington, D.C., by John Halperin. He's the Associated Press reporter who broke the story. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Explain what happened.
Well, we found that some research has been done in Baltimore where they were spreading this Class A sewage sludge fertilizer on lawns in, as you said, poor black neighborhoods, and not fully disclosing all of the risks that are involved with a fertilizer like this. And we investigated.
Now, explain, who were the scientists who were doing this, and what was in the sludge, and how did you hear about this? I mean, you're the UN reporter now for Associated Press, though for years you were, what, the environment reporter?
That's right. I covered the National Environmental Beat for the AP from January of 2001 until November of 2007, and I just transferred to the United Nations. Covered all sorts of stories on the environmental beat. I found sewage sludge to be an intriguing story because it really goes back to the heart of the nation's environmental policies and the movement to clean up the nation's waterways and water pollution and building wastewater treatment plants starting in the 70s. It was one of the biggest projects that EPA undertook, and essentially to get the rivers and keep the oceans clean, they created sludge. And sludge is basically the distilled solids that are removed from wastewater. And in order to cut costs, the sludge is, most of it is returned to the land as fertilizer. There's two different grades, Class A, Class B. The stuff that was involved in the Baltimore study is the Class A, which is of a higher treatment level.
Explain who the families were who accepted that the sludge be spread in their yards.
Well, one of the problems is we don't know exactly who they are. No one will identify them. They were all families from these poor, low-income neighborhoods, black neighborhoods in Baltimore, in so-called empowerment zones. And all of them agreed to take on to have this Class A fertilizer tilled into their lawns. These were basically bald dirt lawns with high lead levels of lead contamination, and the Class A sludge fertilizer was tilled into the lawn to create grass cover, and on the theory that if the children ate the dirt, they would be better protected from the lead contamination because the sludge would mix with the lead in the soil and make that pass safely through the body. That was the researcher's theory.
But, John, these families were given a financial incentive to accept the sludge on their lawn.
They were. They were given food coupons, free lawns, free doormats. We didn't put that in the story. And they were essentially told that this was commercial-grade fertilizer, that it was safe, as you reported, and that they would be better off, that they would be better off using this fertilizer than before. The thing that I found interesting was that this government-sponsored research essentially operates on the premise that this fertilizer is safe enough and good enough to eat, even though the researchers say that the fertilizer was not fed directly to the children. The premise of the research is that if they eat it, they will be better off.
John Halperin, you quote a scientist, Dr. McBride, saying that it's actually not safe for the kids. There's a real question here. The soil chemist from the Cornell Waste Management Institute said, when eaten, it's not at all clear the sludge binding the lead will be preserved in the acidity of the stomach. Actually, thinking about a child ingesting this is a very good chance that it's not safe.
Well, that's right. First of all, the EPA's Inspector General has twice said that there's no way that the EPA can assure the public that sludge is safe. This theory that the phosphate and iron can bind to the lead might work in the soil. However, as Murray McBride said, the stomach acids will probably break down the lead from the soil. In fact, in 2003, another scientist, an EPA microbiologist, David Lewis, had also come to the same conclusion. He was working within the EPA's Office of Research and Development, and he used to call this theory sludge magic.
You also have this soil chemist, McBride, and others questioning the choice of the neighborhoods for the studies and why the families weren't told about the possible harmful ingredients in the sludge that they were allowing to be laid in their yard.
Well, no one knows, of course, exactly why they picked those families or the neighborhoods, but I do think that nationwide, as with the spreading of sludge and with the research, it tends to go to areas where it is not challenged. In sludge spreading, the sludge is generated by cities, big city, rich cities like New York, L.A. They try to get rid of it in more rural areas, predominantly minority areas. And some of this research, as we reported in A. St. Louis, also was done next to an elementary school. It was tilled into the soil next to an elementary school with 300 students, all of whom were black and almost all were poor. No one can say for sure why that was done, but it seems to me that perhaps it's done in areas where there are fewer questions. That's what some of the experts say.
So what's going to happen now? Can you talk about the calls for an investigation by groups like the NAACP?
Well, the Senate Environment Committee is going to hold a hearing on sludge, investigate this matter. There have also been calls for a House committee, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, to get involved, and the NAACP. And I suppose they will generate pressure on the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore and Johns Hopkins.
John Halperin, we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us. A reporter with the Associated Press who broke this story. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Tonight we'll be in New York at the Community Church, 40 East 35th Street, at 7 o'clock as we continue our tour. I want to thank Dennis Moynihan, Sharifa Bokadous. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.